tour of the outer system. And by regular, I mean yearly. It did its run of the asteroid belt, bringing supplies to the mining, prison and shipbreaking stations that dotted that region of the planetoids, before heading for the Tromos Mandeville point and wider trade with the galaxy. I imagine you have never been to a shipbreaker. Few have. They are hard, lonely outposts, isolated from any other point of civilization in a system. This is by design and necessity. The work of these facilities is extremely dangerous, and not just to their personnel. The vessels they work with are naturally beyond repair, and are therefore unstable death traps. There is always the chance of a catastrophic accident. The greatest fear is a plasma engine rupture. There is no chance whatsoever of the crew of a shipbreaker surviving such an explosion. But if the facility were in orbit around an inhabited world, the blast could burn away the atmosphere and scour the surface of life. Therefore, they make provisional anchor on asteroids, far enough from other remote facilities that even the worst disaster would destroy nothing except the station itself. The Ligurian structure was rather like that of a flower, transformed by the filthy hand of industry. Its stem was the long, flexible iron and plasteel anchor that extended from the centre of the facility, down to the surface of the asteroid, where its piston-powered claws punched through the rock and gripped hard. The receptacle housed the control centre and the crew's quarters. At its base were the Ligurian's four wide, stubby engines. The facility was a massive, clumsy, slow-moving beast, unsuited for a journey of any length, but it travelled in-system, abandoning one asteroid and moving on to the next. The four petals that surrounded the receptacle were more like immense, swollen tumours. These were the work bays. They were separate from each other, though they could be connected through temporary filament-like walkways. Their primary points of access were all from the command hub. They were large enough that they could take in small craft or a hewed-off chunk of a larger one, a dead ship's final dry dock. For the larger vessels, which accounted for most of the station's work, the procedure was different. Claws, even larger than the ones that held the Ligurian to its asteroid, grabbed a ship's hull and held it flush against the workbay. Nozzles in the claws sprayed sealant foam, closing out the void. The outer doors of the bay then irised open to the diameter, best suited for the size of the ship. One bay held only a few skeletal remains, while the bay on the opposite side of the hub was latched onto an old colony ship that looked intact. I presumed it was a recent arrival. The ships docked to the other two bays had been there longer and were losing their shape. One I could just recognise as a lifter. The other was a mass conveyor, larger than the one bringing me here. It was huge, and though its superstructure was gone, the great mass of its hull bulked defiantly, its darkness blotting out the stars. Its name, the Cardinal Vizain, was still visible in the bronze runes, 50 feet high around its prow. Its hull was breached in so many places, it looked like a gnawed bone. Each of the great holes marked where the claws had held the Vizain at one point. A section of the vessel was hollowed out by the servitors, and then sealed off to preserve the atmosphere in the next sector to be worked on. As the ships were dismantled, the debris was launched downwards, until, caught by the gravity of the planetoid, it fell to the surface, keeping the approaches to the station clear. The Steadfast came in over the top of the Ligurian, as if avoiding the death grip of the work bays. There was a docking bay on the opposite end of the hub, from the grav platform arm. The mass conveyor synchronized its spin with the Ligurian's and locked itself to the station. The large airlocks opened, and I moved down a ramp that twisted sharply, reorientating me for the gravity of the station. Motorized servitors moved ahead of me, hauling maglev carts of supplies that were then taken by the station's own servitor crew. Velhausen was waiting for me at the end of the ramp. The Ligurian's chief was squat, his head barely as high as my chest. He had a face that looked well lived in. His cheeks sagged, accentuating the pouches under his eyes, and his nose was thick and drooping. He had been running the station for more than 50 years. He was a stolid, competent officer. He was also unimaginative. which made him perfect for a position of isolation and, despite the risks, great boredom and repetition. He grinned as I drew near.
"Good to see you, missionary," he said.
He used my title as if it were a nickname, one that he did not entirely take seriously. I could hardly blame him.
"You too, Vel,"
I said, and tried not to wince when he clapped my back. By the standards of the Ligurian, I was a frequent guest.
"Came all this way to see me, did you?"
Howson asked, just as he had the last 5 times I had been here. Some of those trips had been expensive. I'd had to pay traders a good price to deviate so far off their usual routes.
"You know I did," I said, giving him the bald-faced lie he was waiting for.
Howson laughed, as if this were the first time we'd had this exchange. I think he laughed even harder because it was the 5th time. We walked down the corridor towards the centre of the hub. The walls were grimy black iron. The ceilings were sharply peaking vaults that made the corridors seem even narrower than they were. We were going down one of the main hallways of the station, and there was room for Howson and myself to walk abreast, and for the trudging servitors to pass us on either side. Yet, when I looked along the entire perspective, with the lumen strips creating only enough illumination for a twilight gloom, the effect was like peering into a sarcophagus, whose depths fell away into shadow.
"You'll be wanting to see her, I suppose," said Howson, teasing.
"I thought I might," I said, with false casualness. I was going through the motions of joining in the banter, but my heart wasn't in it. All I could think about was that this might be the last time I was on the Ligurian.
"Of course you did. Of course you did," Howson said. "You'll find her in Delta Bay."
"Thank you. I'll head over there."
"Is she going to convince you to stay with us this time?"
"I really hope she will." He was joking. I was not. We reached the hub, and he paused before heading off to his domain in the command centre.
"Something I did want to ask you," he said, sounding more serious than I was used to.
"Anything.
Would you perform a service for us?"
The jocality slipped away, revealing the devout man beneath.
"It's been a long time since the chapel had a proper ecclesiarch leading the prayers."
I blinked, hesitating. Howson's devotion made me ashamed of my discomfort with my calling.
"Of course," I said, trying to sound more enthusiastic than I felt. "Oh, thank you, missionary."
He looked very happy.
"That will do us all some good. We need to be reminded that we aren't truly alone out here."
He gave my arm a squeeze of gratitude and left me. I followed the ring corridor until I reached the doors to Delta Bay. They were massive, 10 feet high and 20 wide. There were 2 sets, and they were raised at the moment, but were also airlocks and could slam down at a moment's notice in the event of a breach. They would potentially save the rest of the station, but almost certainly doom whoever was inside the bay. That was the way of things. The work the Ligurian did was necessary, but it and its crew were expendable. The station's design and the way it worked factored in that expendability. Only 4 officers ran the Ligurian, controlling the labour of an army of servitors. In the event of a disaster, the losses would be acceptably small. If something went wrong, the 4 were on their own. It would be too risky to send a rescue ship, and it would be less expensive to replace the destroyed facility than to try to salvage it. I entered the colossal space of Delta Bay and was surrounded by the echoing din of demolition. The nose of a lifter protruded through the outer doors of the bay. Scaffolding surrounded it, and a swarm of Monotar servitors climbed over their ship, plasma cutter limbs slicing through the hull, carving it into smaller chunks and opening access to modules that might still be of use. Other servitors, built into mechanized carts, hauled the salvage away. Another group took the detritus and dragged it to the right-hand wall, where they shoved it into the maw of the disposal. This mechanism took up almost 1/3 of the wall in length, and was almost 20 feet high. It was on a slow slope, almost prone. The jaws opened to accept debris,
and then the grinding machinery inside hauled the refuse down to jettison it onto the surface of the asteroid. I walked into the roar, ducking back and forth between smaller clusters of servitors, breaking down fragments of hull and slabs of decking, until I spotted her. Legia Roan was on a low platform, midway between the disposal and the end of the vessel's nose. A nest of mechadendrites reached out from the platform. At her direction, the arms plugged themselves into the spines of waiting servitors, altering their programming for the next task. Roan was the works officer of the Ligurian. The entire process of demolition fell under her supervision, and she was the reason I could not bear the thought of leaving the Tromo system. She saw me as I approached. She waved and held up two fingers. I nodded and waited while she finished redirecting another set of servitors. Then she turned around, surveying the work in the bay, and nodded to herself. She stepped down from the platform and walked over to join me. "That should keep this lot operational for a bit," she said. She smiled. "It's good to see you, Oswick."
"It's good to see you too."
Hardly the most romantic of reunions. But the slack faces of the servitors and the deafening clang and hiss of the work didn't invite intimacy. And I knew better than to do anything that came from the realm of emotions when Roan was at work. She would not appreciate it. She was 5 years older than me, but looked as if she had had far more than a decade's worth of experience over me. In many ways, she had. Working in a facility like the Ligurian tempered a person quickly. She and her shipmates had also served in the Tromos Watch, recalled to the home planet to fight in the war. That was where we had first met, when I preached to her unit of mechanized infantry. Between the war and her work, she had gained a strength that I lacked, and I envied her for it. I have been told that I have a face suited to my calling. My dark hair, pronounced eyebrows, cleft chin and sharp nose apparently convey sternness. I suppose they do. When I preach, I see the desired effect in my listeners. But when I look in the mirror, I see only a perpetual frown, guarding against internal accusations of weakness. Roan was taller than me and wiry, her flesh tight on her bones, as if barely covering an armature of pistons. Her hair, like that of everyone else on the Ligurian, was shaved close to the skull. Compared to the crew, my hair and beard, though modest in length, seemed a luxurious affectation. Roan's face, which had picked up a few more burn scars since I had last seen her 2 months ago, was angular, sharp and questioning. Her dark eyes evaluated everything that came before them, weighing for use and value, and from the time of our first conversation, it had become my great goal to never be found wanting by those eyes. She smiled. I would have conquered the galaxy for that smile. Fortunately, she did not ask that of me. But it was worthy of that enterprise. Just seeing it now gave me the strength to hope there was a way out of the choice I faced. I also felt the sudden vice squeeze in my heart because I knew the hope was in vain.
"Your timing is good," Roan said. "I just finished my tour. The work in Alpha and Beta Bays is in good order, and the demolition in Gamma is almost finished."
"You have a bit of time then?" She nodded.
"Let's go to my office."
We walked back to the hub. Crew quarters were located in a circle off the control center, with the offices linked to both the bridge and the private living spaces. Roan's chambers were on the opposite side of the station from Delta Bay, so we cut through the bridge to reach them. The heart of the Ligurian was a circular space, with Howson's control throne in the very center. All the principal communications and command surfaces were within easy reach of his rotating chair. In between the doors leading to the offices, long viewports gave a panoramic perspective of the four bays. Howson nodded to Roan as we passed through.
"Word from Kren," he said.
Ariadne Kren was the salvage officer.
"Sounds like she's bringing in something interesting. Tell her Gamma will be ready to receive it when she arrives."
Roan's office was not spacious. There was barely room for her simple iron desk. It was not much more than a metal slab fastened to the wall on the left as we entered. With the two of us standing on the same side of the desk,
It was crowded, which was what we liked. Roan put her arms around my neck, pulled me in, and we kissed. I held her tight against me, clutching her strength as if it would support me in all the times ahead. The warmth and softness of her lips shut out the rest of the world. The play of our tongues was gentle at first, then insistent with the exploration of teeth, of our mouths, rediscovering the familiar and the long missed. We kissed with the tender ferocity of the hunger to be ever more completely with the other. When we parted, it was all I could do not to sag against her. It would have been so easy. That was all I wanted to do, to hold her and to be held, to feel the demands of the future melt away before the present joy suspension of time. To give in to this temptation would not have been fair. That would have made my love for her a shallow thing, don't you think? And it wasn't. Even so, Roan took one look into my eyes and saw that I was troubled. She moved to the other side of the desk, not to put distance between us, but to give me the space I needed to breathe and to speak my mind. She didn't sit down. She leaned against the other wall, folded her arms, and smiled. She smiled gently, encouragingly. There was a touch of sadness there, too, as if she already knew what I was going to say and had braced herself for it. "You bring news," she said, "and I don't think it's good." "I'm being reassigned," I said. "There's a crusade leaving Age Mortis to fight the Tau. I'm to be part of it."
"When do you leave?"
I noticed that she did not ask if. I winced. "I'm supposed to go in less than a month. There had been barely enough time for me to get out to the Ligurian and get back to Troma's Prime. As it was, I had been forced to spend most of the credits I owned to arrange for the trader, Discipline's Fire, to make a diversion to collect me on its return journey to the system. It would be here in 10 days. "I am to be. I'm supposed to go," Roan repeated. "Why are you phrasing things this way?"
"You know why. Tell me."
"I don't want to go." Her smile faded, leaving only her sadness.
"I don't want you to go either. Tell me not to."
Her laugh was pained.
"How could I? What do you think would happen to you if you refused?"
"I know, I know." I shook my head. "But I'm wrong for this, Ligia. I'm not a missionary. I've always known that, and it's more clear than ever to me now. I can't leave you."
"You have to," she said softly. "It's your duty."
"My duty," I repeated. I grimaced at the bitter taste of the word. "I'm a lie. I've been placed in a position where, in the long run, I'll do more harm than good."
"What are you talking about? You preach magnificently,"
I snorted. "So I'm told," I said bitterly. "Vel has even asked me to preach to you here."
"That would be wonderful."
"It will be a farce. I'm good with words. That doesn't make me genuine. That doesn't make me a good missionary. Not if my spirit is not in my actions."
Roan didn't answer at first. She frowned, thinking through what I had said.
"You have doubts?" she asked quietly.
"Yes," I said, just as quiet.
"How deep do they run?"
She was whispering now, a look of horror waiting to break the surface of her eyes. I shook my head.
"That's not what I meant," I said, a bit too quickly.
"What did you mean?"
"I think..." I began, then trailed off. I wasn't sure. Did I mean that I doubted myself? But I had already said that. I couldn't bring myself to admit the worst doubt that she now suspected. Not even to her.
"I'm unfit," I said. That wasn't good enough. I cast about for the right words. That was an unusual problem for me. Before I found them, a klaxon sounded.
"Kren is back," said Roan. "We should see what this marvel is she's brought with her." We left the bay. I walked close to her, our shoulders almost brushing. Do I think what could have happened, and what would not have happened, if I had not gone to the Ligurian? If I had quietly accepted my fate and done what I was told? Yes, I do think about that. I do not have any good answers. We returned to the bridge. Barnabas Mesa was there now, too. He was the station's maintenance officer, the only person aboard the Ligurian whose duty it was to hold things together rather than take them apart. He was a big man, brown-skinned and bearded, and with startlingly long, graceful fingers. I had seen him touch ruptured conduits with the tenderness of a parent calming a child. He gave me a clap on the shoulder as we joined him near Howson's throne. Kren was on the vox. "It's a combat vessel," she was saying. "I can tell that much." "What type?" Mesa asked. "I would have said if I knew. I'm not being coy." "Not intact, then," said Howson, disappointed. "Sorry," said Kren. "It's just a section of the hull, but I think there's enough to be interesting all the same."
"Now you're being coy," said Mesa.
"Maybe."
"Where did you find it?" Roan asked.
"It found me. I was about to make for the Antares system to get the governor's yacht they're decommissioning, and this came through the Mandeville point before I could make the jump."
"Sounds like fate," said Howson.
"Must be," Kren said cheerfully. She was close now, and her tug and the load she was hauling became visible through the viewports. The wreckage was maybe 300 feet long, and about half that at its thickest point. Its shape was irregular, looking as if it had been ripped from the larger hole by an explosion. I could see why Kren could not identify the vessel. I'm no expert on void ships, but I was standing with 3 salvage specialists, and they were clearly as baffled as I was. The wreckage was not even part of the exterior of a hull, which would have helped make some kind of identification possible. It appeared to be a portion of the interior of the ship. I could see the strata of decking, though these had been twisted as if a monstrous vice had crushed the ship. The entire ruin was scarred black from fire. At first glance, I couldn't see why she had bothered to capture it instead of completing her run for the yacht. She and her crewmates would have been guaranteed of gathering credit-worthy material from that ship. What she was hauling looked nothing but scrap metal, more usefully sent on a trajectory to the system's sun.
"It doesn't look like much, but I'm getting some readings from inside," said Kren.
"It's still operational?" said Mesa, eyes widening.
"Something is still generating power, and something is receiving it. That's all I know."
"That's good enough for me," said Howson.
The vast majority of the ships the Ligurian broke down were civilian. Military vessels were extremely rare, but when they came through, they yielded salvage of the highest value.
"I thought it might be," said Kren, "bringing it in to Gamma Bay."
We watched as she manoeuvred her catch towards the end of the bay. Her tug's towline morphed between rigid and flexible during the slow dance of huge masses, and Kren brought the wreck close to the bay with efficient grace. Howson engaged the grappling controls, and the huge claws reached majestically out for the wreckage. Once they had hold of it, Kren detached the tug and headed for its dock, a blocky protrusion from the hub between Gamma and Delta bays. As soon as Howson had fixed the wreckage to the bay and engaged the sealant process, we left the bridge to meet Kren. She was waiting for us at the doors to Gamma. She was a small, compact person, no taller than Howser, but densely built, well suited to the confines of her tug. She had a wide smile, and she beamed it at us now.
"You look pleased with yourself," said Roan.
"That's because I am." There was a pick screen next to the doors. It showed a feed of the interior of the bay, along with readouts of the atmospheric and rad conditions.
The 5 of us watched carefully for unnatural spikes. The bay's voidward entrance was irised wide open, giving the broadest possible range of access points to the interior of the wreck. The servitors had gathered at the outer threshold and were standing motionless, slack, awaiting commands. The conditions in the bay remained stable.
"Well?" Kren asked. I think we need more than a few minutes to be sure, Howson cautioned.
When are we ever sure? Said Mesa.
Howson shrugged, conceding the point.
All right, he said. We can begin initial probing.
Remotely, Roan added.
Yes, said Howson. Remotely. Get your servitors ready, Legere. The rest of you, let's try a little patience.
There was no good reason for us to wait by the doors, but we did. Roan left to return to the bridge, where there was a terminal that linked her to some of her servitors. From there, she could control the more basic procedures in the bay. A short while after she departed, a group of servitors jerked into movement and advanced to the wreck. The pick screen updated quickly, showing the glare of their plasma cutters and the start of their work to cut an entrance into the twisted, burned, fused mass. The process was slow. The servitors peeled away thin layers of metal, and there was a short pause every time they made progress while Howson monitored the conditions in the bay. They remained stable, and there were no explosions of escaping gas or ruptured plasma reservoirs. After a couple of hours, Roan joined us again, and Howson opened the doors to Gamma Bay. We went in. Roan headed for the control platform and activated a larger contingent of servitors. Kren and Mesa set up a ring of sensors in front of the tunnel the servitors were carving into the wreck. Mesa carried an Orspex. Howson closed the doors again and returned to the bridge, while I stood beside Roan's platform, watching the work, grateful to have my mind occupied by something other than my future.
A lot of adamantium alloys, Roan said. This is not going to come apart easily.
And if there really is power still on inside?
Then this isn't going to be quick either.
It wasn't. Roan wound up directing the servitors' efforts onto a single access point. Mesa followed the servitors in through the tunnel, calling out shifts of direction as his Orspex picked up more definitive readings. Over the course of the next 10 hours, the tunnel became a burrow, sloping upwards and diagonally through a tangle of crushed decking. Mesa and Kren took it in shifts to follow the servitors with the Orspex. After the first few hours, they had to carry a Vox unit as well to send the reports. The further the tunnel went, the more the interior became recognisable as that of a ship. In the 10th hour, the servitors broke through another massive collapse and onto a deck that was intact. With the interference of crushed walls suddenly removed, the Orspex readings became much clearer.
The way forwards is clear, Kren voxed. It looks like there's a stasis field not far ahead.
The safest approach would have been for Howson to pull everyone back again, and for one officer to go to confirm the energy reading. But if any of the crew of the Ligurian had really been concerned with safety, they wouldn't have been on the station at all. So we all went in. By right of discovery, Kren led the way.
We're not closer to identifying this than we were from the outside, said Mesa.
Fire had swept the decks with such fury that it had melted surfaces and scorched away all markings.
I wonder what happened here, I said.
War, said Roan.
She had witnessed much more of it, much more directly than I had. War happened. She pointed to a fragment of marble cladding on a wall.
Whatever ship this was, it was not unimportant.
We're getting close to the stasis field, said Kren, her eyes on the Orspex.
We slowed and walked silently down a narrow corridor. Then we turned right into an arched doorway, and there we found the Angel. The chamber seemed spacious compared to the tunnel and the broken corridors. It, too, had been destroyed by fire. More truthfully, it was being destroyed. It was square, about 15 feet on each side and 20 feet high. On the other side of the threshold, the air crackled, and Roan put a hand on my shoulder to hold me back. The entire chamber was held in stasis. Shrapnel was suspended in mid-flight, debris frozen in the moment of bursting. And in the centre of the room was a space marine. Have you ever seen one of the Emperor's angels? I had not, until that moment. They had always been figures of living myth for me. I knew they existed. I had heard of their deeds, but they had been tales to be told
things to be wondered at. They were heroes, so far beyond and above the common mortal that, though I could believe in them, I could not conceive of them. Not really. Until now. The Space Marine's armor was destroyed. That must have happened before the stasis field engaged, because the smashed and burned bits of ceramite and plasteel lay in a heap at the Space Marine's feet. He was frozen as he rose on the ends of his toes, his arms high and wide, his mouth open and his eyes closed in what I knew at once was an ecstasy of religious fervour. His hair was golden, and though his features and his body were covered in burns and scar tissue, he was perfection embodied. His wounds were badges of honour, every one of them a step towards earning the rapture I now beheld. There was a pile of stone rubble a few feet in front of the Space Marine. Like his armour, it was too smashed to be reconstructed, but there were just enough larger pieces to suggest what had been there. They were curved, too ornamented to have served any practical function, and their position in the room, with respect to the angel, close to the wall and facing him, told me what the rubble had been. "That was an altar," I said. My voice cracked. I stared at the Space Marine, my emotions crashing like breakers on the rocks of awe and shame. He was an ideal, and he was a rebuke. He was the dream of militant faith made flesh, and he was my nightmare, because he was more than I could ever be. In that immobilized rapture, I saw what I had never wanted, yet should have. I staggered away from the doorway. I wanted to cover my eyes, but I could not. The sight of the angel burned its way deep into my soul. It robbed me even of the strength to cry out as I beheld the wasteland of my pathetic, selfish existence. Do you know what it is to want to scream? To need to scream and be unable to do so? Maybe you do. I think we might have that in common. Then you know something of what I felt then. Yes, you're right. It would happen again in the days ahead. More than once. Yes, I was still naive. That's true, too. I thought this was the worst that could happen to me. I thought this was the worst pain. Throne. I was so very, very wrong.
"What do you mean you aren't going to release him from his stasis?" I demanded.
Howson held up a placating hand.
"The situation is complex," he said. We were in the mess hall of the Ligurian, a chamber off the bridge that held a table just large enough to seat the four officers. Roan and Mesa were in Gamma Bay. Howson and Kren were eating refab rations, consisting of a grey soup and a grey slab of protein. I had come looking for Howson, after what Mesa had told me. He had managed to tap into the power conduits feeding the stasis field, and though the actual source of the power was still buried somewhere in the ship, Mesa had some measure of control over it.
"So, you're going to turn it off?" I had asked.
"No, I'm stabilizing it," Mesa had told me, and when I started yelling, he redirected my anger Howson's way. Mesa was acting on his orders.
"What do you mean, complex?" I said to Howson. "The situation couldn't be simpler. This is one of the Emperor's angels. It is our duty to free him."
"Is it?" said Kren.
"How could it not be?"
"What do you know of Space Marine physiology?" Howson asked.
"Nothing. Why?"
"Because I don't know anything either. And why, do you think, is he in stasis?"
"I don't know," I admitted.
"No, you don't," said Howson. "None of us do."
"This isn't a stasis chamber," Krent said.
Howson nodded.
"Which makes things even more complicated. Was he placed there deliberately? By himself or someone else? Is his situation unintentional, a result of the damage his ship suffered? What happens to him if we turn the field off? What if he is on the point of death now? Oswick, I don't have answers to any of these questions. Are you willing to take responsibility for his death if we make the wrong choice?"
I hesitated, then took a breath. If I must, then... Howson raised a hand, cutting me off.
That was a rhetorical question. You don't have that responsibility because you don't have that authority. I do. And I say that this situation is too complex.
I turned to Crane in mute supplication for aid. She took another forkful of jellied protein and shook her head.
What then? I asked Howson. Are you just going to leave him like that indefinitely?
I have sent word about what we've found. We will await orders and do nothing until they arrive.
I snorted. There were no astropaths on the Ligorian. Howson's message would take days to reach Troma's prime, and there were no Space Marine chapters anywhere in the system. An astropathic message would have to be sent out from Troma's prime, and there was the question of whether anyone knew where and to whom it should be sent. And then there would be the wait for the answer, if any. Communications with shipbreaking facilities were slow and uncertain. They were designed to be self-sufficient, having little need for communications except with vessels in the near vicinity. It could be weeks before we heard something.
And until then we do nothing? I asked.
No, said Howson. Until then we work.
He gave me a pointed look.
The rest of us have plenty to keep ourselves busy.
I was in Roan's quarters, sitting beside her on her cot. It was the end of a shift, a full station cycle after the discovery of the Angel. It was the first chance we had had for a few hours together since my arrival. She had turned off most of the strips, and the light that leaked in from her office bathed the chamber in a dim twilight. Roan put her hand against my cheek, and I leaned into her touch. I did so with too much painful need, and she noticed. She pulled back and placed her hand on mine. "You're grieving," she said. It wasn't the most attractive form of passion. "I'm sorry," I said. "I keep thinking this might be the last time I feel your touch."
"It might be," she said.
"So, should that last memory be a mournful one?"
"I don't mean it to be.
But I look into a future without you, and I can't help but mourn.
You look to the future too much. You're forgetting what you actually have is the present."
I sighed.
"That isn't enough for me." "It has to be. You have to be resigned to leaving the system. You sound like you're resigned to me going. It's not like we have a choice, Oswick."
I knew she was right. I refused to accept that she was.
"I want to fight for what we have," I said. "I wish you would too."
"I am," she squeezed my hand. "I'm fighting for it very hard. You're the one who's turning away from it."
"I'm wallowing in self-pity, is that it? When I should be reveling in the moment."
"Yes," she said, very quietly. Her eyes glittered in the dark, and from the twitch of her hand, I knew that I had hurt her. I grimaced and stared at the floor. "Let's pretend," Roan said, still speaking quietly. The warm, flowing tone of her voice, a sound that I was already missing. "Let's pretend that you use family connections to somehow leave your missionary work without being imprisoned. Let's pretend that's possible." She paused, letting me contemplate the massive implausibility of what she had just said. "So, we're pretending that you can stay in Tromos. And why not? Let's even pretend that you are able to come to the Ligurian as frequently as once a month." That, too, was highly unlikely. The effort and expense of consistently breaking the isolation of a station designed to be as isolated as possible would be enormous. The fantasy she was building sounded more and more ridiculous, even though all she was doing was putting into words the hope that I had been inarticulately holding in a death grip.
"I take your point," I said wearily. "I haven't made it yet, and this is important. Are you pretending all these things?"
I nodded, going along.
"Yes, I am."
"Good. So listen, the present is still all we'd have. There would be no future." "How long do you imagine I will live?"
doing what I do. My breath caught in my throat. That was not a question I could bear to answer. Never that question. She held my hand with both of hers. I have to live for the now, she said. I don't have the luxury of tomorrow. There was a choice here, and she was asking me to face it, and to choose the right path. She was showing me the way forwards. All I had to do was follow. I know that now. And though I keep revisiting that moment because of what flowed from it, I cannot decide if I also knew this then. I can't remember. I want to go back to my earlier self and ask, did you know? Did you? I am also glad that I can't. Whether I knew what I was doing or not, I refused to follow where she led. Living in the moment isn't good enough for me, I said. I wish you would fight for a tomorrow. I wish you believed we were worth the struggle. She let go of my hand and clenched her fists in frustration. What do you want, Oswick? Will making heretics of us both be the only thing that satisfies you? You have to throw away the present and the future? We wouldn't be heretics. How, by the throne, can you say that? We would be disobeying the Emperor's will, you most of all. We don't know what his will is. She was silent for a bit. Have you completely forgotten who you are? She finally asked, and I could barely hear her. No, I wish I knew what his will was. But I don't. I think it would be worse to pretend that I did. Why shouldn't it be his will that you and I should be together? Our meeting was improbable. Roan stood. You're not even thinking what you're saying anymore. I asked you earlier how deep your doubts went, and you didn't really answer me. I still didn't. I said that I wish I knew the Emperor's will. I do. I want to be the one who knows. I stopped, my thoughts racing down to Gamma Bay. Like he knows. Who? The Space Marine. She smiled. You'd like to speak with him, wouldn't you? Yes. Her smile faded. Oh, you're serious? I am. And Housen won't free him from stasis. With good reason. We have to wait for guidance. Your answer won't arrive until long after I'm gone, I pointed out. Then what, if anything, the Space Marine has to say is not for you? Your fate lies somewhere else. Oh, that's trite, Legere. No, it isn't. It's true. She was angry now. You can't have everything right away, she said. I don't expect to. Really? Well, you do want everything on your terms. I stood now, answering her anger defensively with my own, striking back because I knew she was right. Maybe I do, I said. Maybe that's wrong, but what about you? Do you have no terms at all? Do you accept everything that happens with no thought for yourself? Oh, look, I've lost another arm. Nothing to be done, just what was meant to happen. Roan glared at me. Get out, she said. I should have apologized. By the throne, I should have tried. Instead, I stormed out of her quarters. The rations on the Ligurian were not inspiring, but enough to live on. They were, though, other supplies that saw to morale rather than to simple physical sustenance. One of the most vital cargoes of any resupply ship was Amasek. I had come with my own stock, too, knowing that Roan and I would want to share it. We had already, though its effects had been to make me more morose and argumentative. When I left Roan's quarters, I swung by the mess hall and grabbed another bottle. I took a few gulps from it while I walked. Suffused with hurt, convinced of the galaxy's injustice, I wanted drunkenness as an excuse to go where I was already heading, though I gave myself the chance to reconsider. First, I went to the chapel. It was a chamber just off the bridge, larger than was needed for a crew this small, and was the one place on the station with true artistry in the ornamentation, and even some gold inlaid in bronze. I looked at the altar, staring into the empty sockets of the winged skull. I was glad Howson had not yet pressed me to lead the crew in prayer. I had nothing to say. There was no comfort for me here. I received no warmth from the Amasek either. I abandoned the bottle beside the altar and left the chapel. I walked to Gamma Bay. There, servitors hauled the wreckage that had been removed from the tunnel, throwing it into the disposal. Others worked on portions of the ship that had been removed from the main body. The outer layers of the salvage were being taken apart. I moved past them, weaving around islands of work, where the servitors methodically cut down the huge metal bones of the ship. I stumbled once when I misjudged the speed of a track servitor and almost collided with it. For a moment, we were face to face, its flat, dead eyes staring right through me before I jumped out of the way. Then I entered the tunnel and marched as if I had a credible purpose. I think I did have a real one. It was just too vague to be of any guidance. There were servitors just outside the stasis room. One of them was motionless, a mechadendrite linking it to Mesa's stasis control, holding it ready to act if conditions changed unexpectedly. The other was dragging away more debris. I could hear other servitors nearby. They were not enlarging the tunnel while the crew slept, but they were reinforcing what had already been opened up in the wreckage. I brushed past the motionless servitor and stopped in the doorway, just shy of the stasis field. I gazed at the Space Marine, at the transfixion of absolute belief. He could not speak to me, but I could speak to him. "What do you know of doubts?" I said. "Do you even know they exist?" "I know the truth of the God Emperor," I told the angel. "I believe in it. Logia asked me how deep my doubts go. They don't go as far as heresy. I doubt myself, not the Imperial Creed. I believe in the Creed. I..." The motionless, ecstatic face hurt me, but I didn't look away. "I think I do," I said. I barely whispered. The four words horrified me as they passed between my lips. My face burned with shame. At the same time, my skin prickled with the thrill of giving voice to so terrible an honesty. The moment passed as I stared at that face, and I began to laugh with relief. Speaking even the possibility of doubt had exercised it. There was no possibility of unbelief when I was faced with the proof of the Emperor's truth before me. "I believe," I said, and that felt like the truth to me in that moment. Banishing doubt is easy when confronted by a miracle. But I do not feel the truth as I should. How can I preach it when I do not feel it? Am I not, at the very least, a hypocrite? The Space Marine answered with silent rapture. "These are meaningless words for you, aren't they? You can't doubt when you are an angel. Your being is proof of the God Emperor's divinity. There is no such thing as hypocrisy for you." The Space Marine stared at the source of his ecstasy. I followed his gaze, but there was only space. "You feel the truth. You are the truth. Won't you teach me? If I could feel what you do, I would know my path. I would accept my fate." I broke off, choking on the lie. "No," I said. "We both know that isn't true. This is not what I was made for. And I don't understand. I don't understand how the Imperial Creed can be the truth, but still feel to me like a lie." I half expected the inert servitor to jerk to life and strike me down. The frozen ecstasy in the chamber condemned me, and my resentment stirred. "I do not want this fate. I did not ask for it. What good is the truth if all it gives me is pain? And if I leave, what good will I do if I hate every moment of my existence? If I despise my duty, surely I'll be doing more harm than good. It would be better to release me." I paused. "We should both be free," I muttered. I straightened up. I tried to feel as if I was standing my ground.
"If you won't teach me, don't judge me," I shouted, jabbing a finger at the Space Marine. My voice wavered with my confidence as I tried to stare down the face that was looking upon the Divine. My anger remained strong.
"It's easy for you. You are outside of time. Doubts can never arrive."
I took a breath. "Your present is eternal." I spat the sentence out with all my bitterness. I felt as if I could dissolve stone by spitting on it. I wanted to point at the Space Marine and ask Roan if this was how she would like to hold on to the present.
"There's nothing to hold!"
I shouted at the absent woman and the deaf Space Marine.
"The present ends as it arrives. If there is no future, then what good is the present?"
No answer. Always and forever, no answer. Only that accusing, selfish, untroubled, unending rapture. My head was swimming with anger and self-loathing. "I wonder if your joy would stand up to time," I murmured. "I wondered if you would be as holy then." I was projecting my hurt and my doubts onto the Space Marine. I knew what I was doing even then. The pain I felt was too strong, though, to be reasoned away. I did what I did next because of the pain. The galaxy was intent on showing me how unfair it was. Who wouldn't strike out? I'm only human. It wasn't the worst choice I'd made. It wasn't difficult either. Perhaps it should have been, but it wasn't. And really, I don't think you would have done any better. Not in my circumstances.
"You should have to face time too," I said to the Space Marine.
I turned to look at Mesa's control unit. It appeared complicated at first, because I am entirely ignorant when it comes to machinery. There were numerous meters, their illuminated runes meaning nothing to me. After studying the bulky device for a bit, I decided that the readouts were unimportant, as far as I was concerned. They were monitoring the stability of the stasis field and the flow of power. Two large probes jutted from the back of the machine and into the conduit that the servitors had exposed by tearing open the wall near the entrance.
"I don't care about you, or you, or you," I said, looking at the mechadendrite ports and the cluster of dials that I guessed would feed commands to the servitor as needed.
In the end, what mattered was a heavy lever on the side. Mesa had had to use something to start the machine's operation. If this control was not what he had used, it was clearly important enough to do something that mattered. What it would do, I thought, would matter very much to me. I pulled it before I had a chance to reconsider. The meters flashed red. Klaxons erupted with wails of panicked warning. The servitor jerked as a massive shock rolled through it. The mechadendrites pulled free, and the servitor walked forward. It collided with the stasis field. It kept trying to walk in the same direction, but the invisible wall blocked it. The servitor was moving without purpose or task. Blue lightning blasted out from the power conduit. The energy arced across the hall, and I threw myself out of the way, cowering in the doorway as the hall strobed. The chamber of the angel flickered, power levels rising and falling. Then the conduit exploded. A pipe wrenched itself out of the wall like an angry serpent. It smashed Mesa's control unit against the other side of the tunnel. It unleashed a roaring stream of energy down the ruined deck towards the bay, and then died, frozen in mid-strike in the middle of the corridor. In the chamber, the stasis field flashed once, and then it was gone. The explosion it had arrested now continued. Shrapnel cut into the walls and screamed over my head. The Space Marine's altar fell in pieces to the deck, and the Space Marine completed his act of worship. His eyes grew even wider. His back arched. He pulled his arms back as if to embrace infinity itself.
"Hail!"
he screamed. His voice was thunderous, majestic, and yet wrenched out of tune. The rapture I had seen, I now heard, and it pushed rapture beyond ecstasy and into perfect agony.
"Hail!"
he screamed again, and though I covered my ears, I could not blot out that awful shriek. My mind raced in blind confusion. To fear the God Emperor was right, but I had never imagined that to experience the divine would be so much like torture. The Space Marine's eyes bulged with madness. I was grateful that what he saw was beyond my sight and my conception. He cried out again, and his voice was wrong. To the very depths of my soul, I knew that voice was wrong.
"Hell!" he screamed. "Hell! Hell! Hell! Changer of ways!"
And then the angel transformed. The Space Marine grew. His limbs, already massive, thickened until they seemed wide as pillars. He hunched forwards, still screaming his praise, and a row of spikes burst through the skin of his back. Blood and black ichor soaked them as they thrust upwards from his spine. They curved and twisted in every direction, and more of them appeared as the torso grew. Some were the size of daggers. Others were twice the length of my arm. A shudder gripped the Space Marine, powerful enough to make the deck tremble. It started at the base of his neck and travelled down the length of his spine, forcing him to crouch even lower, almost knocking him off his feet. When the tremor reached the end of his spine, his lower back erupted in a spray of liquefied flesh, and a tail uncoiled. It was segmented like the body of an insect, and covered on all sides by rows of more spikes. It ended in a cluster like a tuft of spears. Green liquid dripped from their ends. Where it fell, the decking hissed and gave birth to wriggling filaments that seemed to be forming unholy runes. The Space Marine's head grew with the rest of his body. His skull stretched higher and longer, his eyes becoming long as snakes, their pupils multiplying like a disease, their lids melting away until his flesh tore and reformed.
"Hail, hail, hail, changer of ways!"
The chanted prayer grew even louder, and the walls of the chamber trembled. I did not know how the monster sang, how it shaped the words, because its mouth was no longer human. It howled, and there were two voices at once, the roar of a mad beast and the praise of an insane worshipper. The jaws opened wide as they grew, and they split. Dark blood sprayed from the shredded muscles and flesh. The maw pulled back in four segments, each long and jutting, toothed and scaled like a reptile, yet jointed as if they were mandibles. From within the thing's mouth came a tongue. It was leathery and coated in a thick, viscous slime. It was forked, the two ends moving independently of one another. And in the centre of the fork, there was another mouth. It gaped, revealing human teeth. And while the great maw roared, the tongue chanted. Battered by the double sound of fury wrapped around worship, I stumbled backwards. My mouth opened and closed. I was grasping for something, for anything. Nothing came. As the angel turned into an abomination, a spawn of nightmares, I reached for succor, and no one came to my aid. The change was not complete. Limbs shot up from the monster's shoulders. They were entirely insectile, with at least a dozen joints each. They had a reach of over 15 feet, and they ended in pincers that looked like they could tear a torax open. The monster's skin darkened, turning to shades of deep crimson and black. It stopped tearing, becoming so thick it was now an exoskeleton. Yet, even though it looked hard as iron, it still rippled, as if the forces of its transformation still rocked its being.
"Hail! Hail! Hail! Changer of ways!"
With the stasis field gone, the servitor walked into the room, into the monster's path.
The thing turned its elongated eyes on the figure. It reached out and closed one of its pincers around the servitor's waist. The monster lifted the servitor into the air. The servitor barely reacted. Its legs moved as if it were still trying to walk. The monster waited for a moment, as if expecting distress. When none came, it snapped the pincer closed and sliced the servitor in half. The servitor never showed pain or fear as its body parted in two. It could not. Yet, as bones snapped and blood flowed and intestines spilled heavily to the deck, I was confronted with the fact that this had been a human being, and that there would be nothing to distinguish me from those slabs of butchered meat if the monster seized me. From the entrance to the chamber, I watched the transformation and the killing of the servitor from a point of physical and spiritual paralysis. I seemed to be floating just to the side of my body. I was numb with fear and horror. All trace of reason had fled the galaxy, and I could not respond. I did not understand what I was seeing. There was nothing in my training or in my studies that permitted such a reality. Everything I believed in, everything I thought to be true, fractured before the existence of this monster. I had believed the Space Marine was proof of the divine. Instead, the monster was its refutation. This was the crushing sensation that formed during the eternity of the transformation and the seizing of the servitor. But as the mutilated body fell, I realized something else, and I began to recover control over my thoughts and my limbs. This monster was proof of the supernatural. It was an abomination that opposed the truth of the Emperor, and in doing so, proved that truth. I had wanted an end to doubt. There it was, standing before me. And I was a missionary of the Adeptus Ministerium. I was the voice that spread the Emperor's word. Here, now, at this terrible juncture, I stood for the Emperor. It was through me that he would banish this horror from existence. It was my duty to act. This was not the moment of choice, because there was no choice at all. I reached for my belt with an instinct I had not believed I possessed. I seized my icon of the Emperor, a winged skull on an iron rod, and I raised it before me. Words sprang to my lips, words that would have rung hollow until now, because now I saw what these words were meant to combat. In the name of the Emperor of Mankind, our Father, our Guardian, and our God, be gone, foul thing! The monster cocked its head. Its unholy eyes blinked at me in curiosity. Its pincers opened and closed, snapping at the air. The mouth and the tongue stopped chanting for a moment and hung open, glistening with drool, waiting for me to finish. I took a step forward and stretched my arm towards the monster. I held the icon tightly. It was already slick with sweat. "Return to the foul pit from whence you came," I said. "I renounce you. I banish you. I cast you out. Let no human eye see you. No human ear hear you. No human heart feel your presence ever again. Be gone, abomination. Be gone." Even in my terror, I felt a rush of pride that I had found the strength to stand my ground. And I felt the first stirrings of true religious ecstasy. The rapture I thought I had seen in the Space Marine would now be mine, because I would feel the hand of the Emperor. I would feel his will act through mine. I would know the grace and wrath of the Emperor as he burned this monster from existence. Nothing happened. The monster stalked out of the chamber towards me, its spikes bristling.